Welcome to the Editing Lawyer Podcast. I'm Benjamin Scott Wright, an attorney in Wisconsin, and I'm talking to other lawyers and professionals about writing, editing, and publishing. This week I'm talking to Carolyn Elephant, and I'm sure you don't need me to tell you who she is. Carolyn wrote an ebook that has pushed a ton of business to her practice over the years. We talked about her experience writing and publishing that ebook and her advice for other attorneys. I'd hoped to talk to Carolyn about her experience writing and publishing her book, Solo by Choice, as well, but she had so much to say about writing an ebook that we ran out of time. I'll do another episode with Carolyn in the future. And now, on to our show. Carolyn, thank you for talking with me today. So I just want to first say that it's I'm really excited to talk to you. You've written a lot, and you know, especially Solo by Choice, which is something that I relied on as a young solo attorney. So first I wanted to thank you for talking with me, and thank you for the things that you write. So for anybody who doesn't know, who are you, what do you do, and what does it have to do with writing ebooks?
So my name's Carolyn Elephant. I am both a practicing lawyer and a blogger and book author. My law firm focuses on energy-related matters. I represent renewable energy companies and also landowners and municipalities impacted by pipelines. And I blog at myshingle.com, which is the longest-running blog on solo and small firm practice. We're going on 16 years in December, so it's been around for a while. And I guess my experience with ebooks, I mean, I've actually written ebooks both for my shingle and for my law practice. The ebooks I wrote for my law practice were designed to draw clients to my business, and the ebooks for my shingle were also designed to draw people to the website and allow me to put them on a circulation list where I could notify them about upcoming events or programs.
Yeah, so I think we're talking specifically because you recently had a webinar that I attended called the 7-Figure Ebook, all about, I think it was the first ebook you wrote and how that generated a lot of business for you. So I'd like to talk about your experience doing that. I'd start by just asking, you know, how did you end up writing that ebook, and what's the story behind that sort of, I think it was your first foray into that sort of a thing. What's the story behind that?
So I did recently have a webinar on 7-Figure Ebook about the ebook that drew a lot of business to my practice. And the way that it started was I had been doing energy regulatory work for a long time, and I was asked to work with a group of landowners who were impacted by pipelines. And I got involved in the case. I took on another case. It was really interesting, but at that time, there wasn't really that much going on in that area. So I thought, I'm just going to put together all of the information that I learned through this year-long experience of representing this group so that I have it for future reference, and maybe it can, I guess I may have thought in the back of my mind I could use it for another purpose. So I just sort of did a brain dump of all of the resources that I put together while working with the group. I looked through my emails. I saw, you know, people who had sent in, you know, I had spoken to a large group of landowners, and there were questions, recurring questions that would come up. When I spoke at one or two public hearings, there were certain concerns that were repeated. And then I also noticed that there were some of these individuals who weren't adequately protecting their rights because they didn't know that they had to. And so by the time they found me, there really wasn't much that I could do for them. And so I put all of the information into the ebook, again, both to have it for myself, because this had been a new area for me, so I had to research a lot of the answers. And once I'd done that, I didn't want to lose that resource. And the second thing is I also, as I was putting it together, realized that it could help other people understand what their rights were, whether they had a case. And so that was kind of the impetus behind it. And when I finished it, it turned out to be very long, and I put it up on my website with little fanfare, just thinking that it would be downloaded by the people who visited my site. But as it turned out, people found the book really valuable, and it started to get circulated through community groups, even through the agency that that is responsible for permitting these types of pipelines. They would give the ebook out to people who called with questions. And so I found that it sort of took on a life of its own.
Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, you said your initial motivation was really, I mean, it was, you were your own audience, I guess. You just wanted to collect all the information into one place. And then it sounds like as you were doing that and collecting it, you realized this might be something that would be, you know, useful to the sort of people you had been working with at that point.
Yeah, that I think that was what happened is, you know, as I was putting it together, I realized that if these types of cases were out there, the book could be a useful resource to people who were directly involved in the case. And I also thought that there, you know, there were also ways that the book could be useful to, you know, to other people who were working with landowners who might not be familiar with this regulatory process. So, you know, to some extent, the book was directed at individual clients, but it was also directed, it was also intended to help, you know, community leaders who might have to protect their constituents, or, you know, real estate attorneys who might get a call from somebody saying, hey, this pipeline's going to be on my property, what do I do? And the local real estate attorney doesn't know what the process is in Washington, D.C., they could see this book and also use it as a resource, either to inform their client or more likely to direct, pass it on to their client and have the client contact me.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to put that on your website? Was that like a quick decision for you, or were you a little bit nervous about putting this thing out there?
So back then, this was like around 2010, and I guess my feeling about information has always been to make it available and make it widespread. I felt that my background in this area was so unique. I had worked at the regulatory agency that was involved in these pipelines, so I'd had, you know, personal experience working with it, and I had knowledge of these cases. So I wasn't really that concerned that competitors would download the information and poach it from me, because it was very specialized. In terms of potential liability, I personally never felt that informational books could give rise to malpractice claims or create attorney-client privileges. I did put a disclaimer in the front just to kind of, it was really more to make the book look official than anything else. But, you know, I considered it to be more along the lines of a book like a Nolo Press book, or a For Dummies book, where it's just generalized information that is intended to educate people and not provide specific advice to a set of particularized facts.
Yeah. And just to ask the question, have you ever had any issues, run into any you know, legal problems or problems with potential clients or anything because of it?
No, I haven't had any problems with that. Sometimes people will come to me and they'll quote something that I've said in the book, and you know, the one issue now is, you know, the book is dated from 2010. I haven't done any formal updates, but I have created a couple of other resources. But there is some information in the book that, I mean, it's not outdated, but the way things have evolved, I have, my advice has sort of been refined in terms of the approach that I might take. So sometimes people will ask me when I propose an approach to them now, they'll say, but you said this in your book. And I'll say, well, you know, that was how the landscape looked at that time, but I think that this approach works better now because of these reasons. That's really the closest I've come to being called on what I've committed to print.
Yeah. Have you thought about what you would do if something big enough changed where that book really did become outdated?
That's a really good question. I have had it on my to-do list to update it for a long time, and I just for one reason or another, I guess, because now I'm so busy with the cases that it's generated, I haven't really had time to do that. I think certainly if there was information in there that was, you know, if there were was a case in there that was overturned or, you know, vacated by a court, I would probably, you know, like just slap a like a pocket part on it and just say, you know, this information is not accurate anymore. Other than that, that's sort of the extent that I would go to, you know, to really changing it. I mean, the other thing is that, you know, because it is from 2010 now, I don't promote it as much as I used to. When I used to go out and speak to groups, I would either bring copies or I would direct people to the link. I don't do that as much anymore. I'd be more inclined to direct them to, you know, to a PowerPoint presentation or other materials that that I have. Updating it is a really good idea, and like I said, it's on the to-do list.
So to circle back and kind of wrap up the just kind of the why, like how you got started, I guess we've kind of covered how you put this out there basically because you thought it was useful to you. You thought it would be useful to some people, and that, it sounds like that was kind of the extent of your thought about it. Did you have, like, when you published this, when you put it out there, did you have any real goals for the book or any purpose behind it apart from, you know, besides just, I think this might be useful, or was it really just kind of like, you know, putting it out there and seeing what happens?
It was really, honestly, it was very experimental. I thought that it would be an additional resource if these cases came up, but it was really very experimental. I didn't expect all that much to come from it. I mean, again, at that time, like in 2009 and 2010, I mean, there were certainly attorneys who were marketing their practices online. I mean, by then, SEO and blogging to attract clients was something that was very common. I just didn't have great expectations for that because the area is very niche, and you know, I thought that people would be able to find it, but it wouldn't be the type of lead that would attract, you know, thousands of people a day. So I knew that, you know, people would find it, but I guess I didn't expect it to spread as much. And I really didn't think, I thought that if it did bring business in, it would be in a situation where somebody had gotten, been referred to me and was trying to make a decision, and I would, you know, give them a copy of it to show them that I knew what I was doing. I mean, that was the extent to which I thought it would serve a marketing purpose.
So what did happen? How, you know, how did this actually generate business for you?
So, like I said, so that was what, you know, was sort of the interesting part of the experiment, so to speak, because as it turned out that, you know, once I had put it out there, you know, if I, more pipelines started coming along. I mean, that was the first thing. And a lot of the people who were getting involved in these cases were turning to the internet as a source of information, and also, you know, as a way to sort of use Facebook pages and, you know, internet groups to kind of, you know, organize landowner groups or community groups. And so these people were very involved online. So some of these groups would host meetings to, you know, to inform the public about the pipeline and what to expect. And so they would find my ebook online and they would circulate it, or they would find the ebook and then they would ask, they would call me to ask if they could circulate it and ask if I would, you know, do a webinar or speak to them virtually, because a lot of these communities are, they're all over the country. So that was one source of the information getting around, with that other community groups were starting to pass it along. And then what would happen too is it sort of had this ripple effect, because as pipelines were being proposed in different parts of the country, these newer form community groups would, you know, reach back to the older ones and they would say, you know, what resources are available. And so it would sort of go from group to group. So that was kind of one way that it got around. The other way I discovered it was getting around was the agency that regulates these pipelines. They have a hotline for landowners and you know, who would call to ask questions. And this dispute resolution group, they deal with a whole variety of energy issues, not just pipelines. And so most of the people manning these phones are very generalist. And so when people called and the question was beyond the scope of their knowledge, they would pass my ebook along to them. So that was another way that it was getting around. And then soon I would find, when I did searches, I would find that it had been posted on somebody's Facebook page, or it had been posted on the, you know, Parents Against Pipelines website in Massachusetts. And so it started to circulate that way as well. And so, it, like I said, I mean, I really felt like it took on a life of its own at that point.
Yeah. And so it sounds like it really spread pretty organically. And to be clear, you know, you didn't charge anything for it, right? It was just a PDF people could download from your site.
Right. And I knew from my experience with working with many of these landowner groups, many of these communities that pipelines identify as appropriate sites, they're often in rural area or equal, the Equal Justice, not Equal Justice Act. They're in urban areas where with people of lower income, older people. And so I felt that if I were to charge anything for it, it would just be too much of a barrier to people to download it. So I felt that the best way to get it into people's hands was to just have it available for free. And I don't even think I had, I think it was just posted on my website as a PDF. I didn't even make people, you know, give their email and sign up for it. You know, that's something that I think is less of a barrier. I think people are willing to give their emails and download, especially like if you give them a sample chapter or something like that, so they know they're not just, you know, getting on a junk list. But in my case, it just was made available immediately.
As this ebook spread, obviously, and a lot of people started using it, so how did that translate into business for your practice?
So it happened in, again, a couple of different ways. Sometimes somebody in a community would find it and they would decide that they wanted to oppose the pipeline. And so what happens in these cases, just to take a step back, is there's sort of two phases. There's the regulatory phase where the agency, the regulator, makes a decision about whether to approve this pipeline or not. And then after the pipeline is approved, there's a second process in court, which is an eminent domain procedure. So most people, you know, until my book came out, they figured that you just wait until the court proceeding and then you raise all your issues. They didn't realize that by then it was too late. So when people saw my book, they saw opportunities to get involved in the process earlier. And so you know, so like I said, sometimes like a landowner group would find the book and then they would call me and they would ask if they could, you know, if they could retain me. And so as I started getting calls at different parts of the process, I developed different, you know, sort of a different menu of services that I could make available to people. Sometimes it would be attorneys who would find the book. They might either be, you know, eminent domain attorneys who wanted to find a way to give themselves a better advantage in the eminent domain process by opposing the pipeline, or their clients had made very clear to them that they did not want their property taken in eminent domain. And so these attorneys tried to help their clients find a way to oppose the pipeline. Sometimes I'll also be called in, once or twice I've been called in on cases by attorneys who had existing clients, you know, for different matters, who represented them in, you know, environmental litigation or just in, you know, estate planning and things like that. And they would, you know, bring me in to be involved in the case. I've also been brought into cases by environmental consultants who were engineers who had been retained initially by the clients. And then when they realized that, you know, they might, for example, map out an alternative route, and then they would tell the client, you know, look, I can do this alternative route, but I can't make sure that it's going to get in front of this regulatory agency. So, you know, there's this attorney that I'm familiar with, and they'd refer the case to me.
It sounds like there's quite a number of ways this ended up coming back to you. Were you surprised by all the, the different ways this came up and came back to you in business?
So I was initially, I was really surprised, but then, I started thinking about it. And when you sit down and think about it, you think of all of the different ways that people can learn about information. I mean, I think I've seen these statistics saying that, it takes like 4 or 6 different touches before contacts before somebody decides to make a decision to hire you, and all of those contacts may can't come from different places. So like if you sit down and you think about all of the possible different ways that clients can find you, then it started to kind of the pieces fit together. But it wasn't until I looked at it retrospectively that I became aware of that. And once I realized that, one of the things that I started doing after this had gone on for a while is I reached out to a couple of eminent domain attorneys and, gave them these resources. And, we talked about like kind of figuring out ways to collaborate on some of these cases with me doing the regulatory part and then them doing the eminent domain part. So once I realized it had that effect, I started to take advantage of it a little more. But I think that, that's really something where a lot of lawyers miss out because they are always thinking there's a lot of talk about figuring out who your ideal client is and where the ideal client resides and how to get in touch with them. And there's a lot of focus on the ideal client, which of course is very important. But you in doing that, you forget about all of the secondary and tertiary ways that these ideal clients get their information. They get it from other professionals, they get it from friends and colleagues and, other places besides just searching the internet or, seeing ads on Facebook pages.
So obviously this ebook was quite successful for you. I think during your webinar you said it, over 6 or 7 years it, probably generated 6 or 7 figures of income for your just a business for your practice.
Right.
And since then you've written other ebooks, you've published other of this kind of similar type of content. And I mean you mentioned you've done this sort of thing both for your own law practice and for MyShingle. So how does that first ebook that was very successful in pushing business to your practice compare with the efforts you've had since then? How have those kind of panned out?
So some of, I mean, I guess for my practice, I've done really not so much an ebook. I guess for one area of my practice I've been exploring, I've been doing just a very targeted newsletter. I haven't really reached a point of turning it into an ebook. So I really ha I have ideas for doing it again, but I just, like I said, I've been busy with work from this book and and other projects. So I just have not yet had the time to put together another one for my practice. But it's again, it's like it's on the list. The ebooks that I've put out for my shingle, I mean, I guess around the same time I put this ebook out, I had put out an ebook on social media for lawyers, which again, back in 2010 was something that was really just emerging. I mean, today there's 10 gazillion resources on social media marketing for lawyers. And, I find that those ebooks and a lot of the downloads that I have at my shingle, and those always help to build my mailing list and my readership, which is important because I have ads on the site.
Can you talk a little bit more about that side of things then? So, I mean, you talk about having a mailing list and building readership as its own, that's a little bit of a different goal than
Right.
generating business in a law practice. So what's, I guess what's the reasoning behind that, and how does that change your approach to things like creating this kind of written content? Whether it's an ebook or whether it's something smaller.
So I find that, with a website, and I mean, this was also a learning experience for just building and growing the blog because I don't really have any marketing training. And I know how to sell my services as a lawyer. I don't necessarily know how to sell my, my website or my content. But what I find with, downloadable content at sort of like marketing consulting sites, people are always very interested in downloading it and will join your list. But I think a lot of times the people who wind up on the list have sort of two different motives. And, they're not necessarily going to become readers of the site or make a purchase of the services that you're offering unless you sort of have to continue to provide them information or content through the mailing list or continue to offer them things. So I think it's a little different. I feel like with an ebook targeting a potential legal need, I feel like the people who read it, have an immediate need, otherwise they wouldn't be looking at it. Whereas with content for to drive traffic to a website, people may be mildly curious about it, but they won't necessarily have that immediate desire to, to follow the website or to, to purchase other paid programs through the website.
So, if other lawyers are interested in writing their own ebooks after hearing about your experience, I guess what would you have to say to them? Why, how should they think about starting a project like that? What should the motivation and goals be? And then, why should they, I guess, why should they consider it in the first place?
So I think that there's a number of reasons to consider doing the ebook. First of all, like I said, depending on the type of practice that you have, just the process of putting the ebook together can either be a way to kind of aggregate all your knowledge, or if you're an attorney with associates or other attorneys working for you, it's a really good way to get them familiar with some of the issues. I said I had done like two sort of supplemental projects to large ebook, and I had some of my summer associates work on those. So that's one reason. The second thing is that when you put this ebook together, it can help to drive business to your firm, and it also just gives you storehouse of content that you can use to continue to market your practice over the year. If you have an ebook on, say you put together an ebook on something related to a family law process, one thing I talk about with my ebook is I think one reason it was successful too is because it had so many different features. It had flow charts and diagrams, but it also had FAQs and it had, some more lawyerly content. So if you create that information for your ebook, you can also circulate those different features on social media, or you can do blog posts about them. The other thing is that the ebook can help you to network with other professionals. So if you're a family law attorney and you want to try to get referrals from therapists or from people at your church or your synagogue, you can give this information to, you can approach people and just tell them that you've got this resource available that can be helpful to them. And so it's a way to also, to reach out to professionals, to other professionals or even other attorneys. So it gives you just an ebook kind of forces you to put all your information together at one time and then to kind of disseminate it over a period of, the ensuing months or years. And so it sort of, continues to give you a resource of content. And, content marketing is obviously very important to attorneys. And the more information that you can put out, the more you can help educate people about their legal problems and have them come to you to look for solutions.
Yeah, how would you recommend an attorney who was looking at, thinking about writing their own ebook? How would you recommend they go about deciding on a topic or a focus or what to actually cover in that ebook?
So I think there's a couple of things. I mean, first, you do want to pick a topic that you're interested in and that addresses the kinds of cases you want to handle. If you can't stand Doing a certain type of case, you don't want to do an ebook on that because it will drive people with those types of cases. I think you also want to kind of, look back on the past 6 months or year of your practice, and maybe this is anecdotal, or maybe you are very good about keeping CRM software and you keep records of all the phone calls you get and the questions that people have. But, if you start looking back or thinking back on the kinds of things people ask you, these patterns start to emerge. And so you may find, based on your own recollection or any, software or data that you have, that there's certain issues that seem to be recurring. Or you might identify there may be a new case out there that, based on your experience, is going to cause issues to arise in the future, and people are going to have questions about it. So you want to kind of think about the kinds of cases you want to handle and, sort of look at trends in your practice or in the broader legal community. And then the other thing you want to do to sort of make your life easier is look to see whether you've already generated content on some of those questions. You may have, spoken at a bar association meeting or a PTA meeting or a community group meeting, and you might have a PowerPoint that you can convert into content for the ebook. Or you may have, had a couple of attorneys, reach out to you and say, "Hey, I've got this client, he's got this family law issue. Can you just give me a brief background?" And, as professional courtesy, sent some information to them. So you want to try to gather up the materials you already have, because that's going to make writing it a lot easier and a lot faster.
Yeah, so it sounds like, what you did was you obviously had a lot of material that you just collected, and you're saying a lot of attorneys probably have more than they realize. They probably already have a lot of the content that they'll need. So when you were putting yours together, how long did it take you? How much work was it? And then, how much do you think, how much work do you think attorneys should expect it to take to put together a good ebook?
So I guess, the first thing I did was, I did gather content. I had done one or two presentations on this, and I had, some email questions. So I had maybe like 50 or 60% of the ebook in raw format in, different shape or another, maybe 50, 60, 70%. And so I started with that, and I created an outline, and I started working with the material I had, and I identified certain areas where I needed help, where there were questions that were coming up that I didn't have the answers to, or where there were questions that I was coming up with. And so for that portion of it, I worked with a contract attorney, and I had her just, do, I think she did about 10 hours of research for me, and research and writing to put that portion of the ebook together. So I think I had done this ebook, I think it was over the course of, it was either a weekend or, like a summer vacation or something. It was maybe like two days of working on it focused, and then there was another day of, I mean, my formatting was not the greatest, but maybe like a third day. But I think an ebook, it can definitely be put together in, the span of a weekend or a 2 day period. The thing is that you need to set the time aside. When I decided to start doing it, I did set the time aside for it. I didn't like write 2 lines and then go back to it. I think then that would have been a re recipe for disaster. I don't think I would have finished it then.
Oh, I just wanted to ask, did you, I mean, I don't, you said yours was kind of rough. Do you think, how much, I guess, production value do you think an ebook should have? Is it helpful to have more professional help, like in like an editor or somebody who can format it nicely? How important do you think those things are?
So I think, I mean, in 2018, there is sort of a higher expectation of how something should look than there was 8 years ago. And there are also better tools for, desktop publishing, for, formatting things, and also resources like, on sites like Fiverr or Upstart, Upwork, where you can, where you can find people who can, do a decent job of formatting for not that much more. So I guess what I would say to the issues like formatting, I wouldn't let that serve as a barrier. I mean, if the best you can do is just a PDF with a couple of colored subheadings, as long as it's, proofed and there aren't typos, I mean, it should still, satisfy at least, decent legal standards, especially if other attorneys or professionals are going to read it. But I mean, if that's really all you can put together is just something that's like a Word document converted into PDF, I would do it that way. But, if you have like a few extra resources, I would again look into these sites like Fiverr or Upwork. There's also there's a site called Beacon that has these sort of very easy to use desktop publishing books for putting ebooks together. And the one and I know some people also use Canva to kind of create ebooks. The one problem I have with those services is those are really more better designed for shorter ebooks, for just like 5 or 6 page ebooks. If you have to put like 20 pages of content, you sort of have to like upload it into these little page boxes. It could, become very time consuming very quickly. So, but those are the resources. And so if they're out there, I would, consider using them, but I wouldn't let that serve as an obstacle. And I certainly would not like do that first, like spend 5 months, like trying to get a cover designed and not actually do the content.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned, I guess I should ask, how long was your ebook and how much content do you think should be in there to, to be something substantial, I guess?
So mine was fairly long. I think mine was probably about 40 or 50 pages, but it wasn't, first of all, it wasn't all text, and it was in different formats. So there were probably like 5 pages of frequently asked questions. There were also like 4 or 5 flow charts of, showing the process the agency follows. I also included statutes and regulations. Sometimes people actually like to see that. You think, well, it's online, they can go to the link, but people don't always do that. I mean, I think a lot of people still consume this ebook content by printing it out, and so it would be helpful to them if they decide they want to look at a regulation to have it available. I think that, the length, of course, is going to depend on the subject matter material, and you don't want to, include a lot of junk in it. I mean, if you're doing an ebook on like, whether somebody is classified as an independent contractor, you could find like 87 legal briefs on that, and you don't want to like just attach the briefs just to, have a big bundle of stuff. But I do think it has to be substantial. I think that one problem is people go to download these ebooks and they're often a disappointment. They expect to get all this content and they get like a 2-page checklist that, are kind of things they could have thought of themselves. And then the last thing is always, and be sure to consult a lawyer if you have these issues. And, they downloaded the ebook to try to, figure out whether they, could actually address some of these issues without a lawyer or not. So I would say that in order to really set it apart and make it something valuable, I mean, just I would say, at least 8 to 10 pages, but again, it doesn't have to be all text. There can be, and there can, and there should be diagrams, charts, sample forms, all kinds of different materials like that to kind of break things up.
Yeah, and is that the kind of thing you might, you could probably have help with creating that kind of thing, infographics and charts, and that's the thing what a site like Fiverr or Elance
Yeah.
might be helpful with.
Yeah, and those are really good things. I think if you're going to invest the time in something, those are good things to invest time in because those are things that also have a potential to go viral. So, if you have like a really neat chart that shows that that bears out a certain point, and or a chart of just showing how long a process is. That's the kind of thing that people, are also apt to pass around and stuff. So, yeah, and those are things that are, yeah, I mean, you could get them created for like $10 or $20.
Well, I'm just going to have a couple more questions for you. You didn't charge for your ebook, and it was obviously you've seen a lot of return from it in business. But I think whenever you write something substantial that's really useful content, it's a natural question to think, well, can I charge for it? Should I? Is that maybe a way to make some money from this? Do you think other lawyers should consider charging for ebooks, and when do you think that might be appropriate?
So I think it's really a cost-benefit analysis. You have to think about, whether the revenue that you can generate from doing the ebook is going to outweigh the cost of cases that it brings in, or whether it will also complement the cases that you bring in. I know there are a couple of attorneys who do work in like the trademark and copyright space who put together kind of paid guides for people like entrepreneurs to, how to get your own trademark or how to do a copyright or how to set up a business. And, those ebooks are sold to a wide audience and they generate lots of revenue. And then sometimes those readers, discover that they also need help and they wind up hiring people too. So I think that that's a situation where selling the ebook could work, where you're just sort of targeting people who have maybe ongoing, well, it doesn't necessarily need to be an ongoing legal problem. I think other times selling the ebook can just sort of be, it can be a barrier to people getting the information from you. And, when you sell it, it's not necessarily going to pay you back. So, and I guess it depends, also what the ebook covers. I mean, if you're, if you sell an ebook, on a topic like, how to do a divorce yourself, that's a tool that people might use. And so they might be inclined to buy something like that. But if you just do an ebook, this is how the Wisconsin divorce process works, and you charge $30 for that, I think people are less likely to purchase that because it doesn't really give them something tangible to use. So I think you have to think about, your audience and what their needs are, and also, their likelihood to actually, to use the ebook and the tools that it provides, and pay for something like that versus whether just putting it out there free will make them more likely to hire you. And I've never really, I kind of, I mean, obviously I'm not an expert on all practice areas except my own. Some hunches on when they would work, when it might work as a paid book. I think it's mostly going to work as a paid book where a person has a problem that's acute and they need a tool to solve it immediately. So somebody who, is starting a business and has a unique, they've, paid for a unique trademark and they need to have a trademark and they just don't have $2,000 to hire a lawyer, they will probably be likely to pay $75 for an ebook that, does a step by step of how to get a trademark, whereas somebody else who is just kind of interested in estate planning, isn't gonna, buy a book on, all the things that you should know. So there's a lot of experimentation with this too. And, you can always put the ebook out and, you can try selling it. And if it doesn't sell, you can make it available for free at that point. Or vice versa. If you put an ebook out and people tell you that it's something that's really useful, you might decide to do a second iteration with paid portions in it too.
The workshop that you or the webinar that you put on, that's recorded and available online, right?
Yes, that is available. I'm trying to think where it is. I know I'm going to put up a link on my website. I don't have the link offhand, but we're going to put up a link to the recording in the sidebar of the website, and people can get hold of it that way.
Yeah, and I'll make sure that link is in the
Oh,
notes for this
great.
show. If and then I at the end of that webinar, you mentioned coming up soon sometime, I think you're going to be doing your own workshop to kind of jumpstart attorneys who want to put together their own ebooks.
Yeah, so it's called an ebook sprint, and I'm putting together, I'm just finishing up a workbook for people who can use as part of the sprint to sort of get their thoughts together. But, I feel like with something like an ebook, it's the kind of project that is, doable within a finite period of time. And I'm thinking of, I mean, there may possibly be an on-site workshop, but I'm also thinking that I may, what I'll do also is sort of run a sprint online, either, 2 half days where people call in and actually work on the ebook as part of the workshop, or maybe, an hour or two a day over a 5 day period, because I think that this is really, I think that, there's tons of marketing materials online and all kinds of information, and really the only options people have are either to go to a webinar where they tell you what to do, or go to a conference and you learn all this great stuff and you go home and you don't do it, or to hire somebody who can do it for you, but it's also going to cost you a few thousand dollars. And I'm trying to come up with workshops where people can, while they're there or while they're taking it, actually create the product. And I think with something like this, I think it's very doable to do within that period of time. So that's probably something, I'll probably start sending materials out for that in the next week. And I think the online version may start sometime in October, and looking at dates for doing, if there's a demand for an in-person one, it would be a few months later.
Okay, I'll definitely include any information about that in the notes as well and look forward to that. I guess just to conclude here, do you have any more advice for lawyers who are interested in writing and publishing their own ebooks that we didn't cover already?
I think one thing would be is, whether you're writing for other professionals or for clients, I think it's important to be conversational and engaging in your writing, to get people to really read the material. So I think that the kind of tone that you want to use is a little bit different from, the tone you might use in a memo or even in a brief. And I think that sometimes lawyers have some difficulty kind of achieving that sort of conversational tone. What I think is helpful, actually, is sometimes I kind of talk it out loud, as if I were explaining the issue to, to a friend or somebody like that. I mean, sometimes that's very helpful in kind of striking that conversational tone that you really want to have. You don't want to dumb things down, but there are many ways that you can speak about complicated issues, but still do it in a very engaging and approachable manner.
Okay, well, thank you so much for having this conversation, Carolyn. And if anybody wants to find out more about you or about this topic, where should they go?
They can just go right to my blog. It's myshingle.com.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Editing Lawyer Podcast. If you're a lawyer interested in writing, editing, or publishing, check out my blog at editinglawyer.com or follow me on Twitter at Benjamin S. Wright.